Welcome to Conversations in Cannabis. Today's episode features Tim Blake, founder of legendary Californian cultural cannabis event and competition, the Emerald Cup. This episode was recorded over the phone on February 2nd, 2021.
Tim Blake, founder of the world-renowned Northern California cannabis consumer event, the Emerald Cup, and also co-founder of the Mendocino Farmers Collective, as well as Healing Harvest Farms Dispensary. He's also a founding member of the California Cannabis Reform Policy, as well as a founding member of the Mendocino Cannabis Policy Council, and has been active in both cannabis advocacy, as well as both the industry in one way or another for over 30 years. Tim, so nice to be able to talk to you today.
I'm honored. I had a couple great conversations with you, Nick. I think you're doing some great work yourself, and it's a pleasure to have the time.
Wonderful. So let's just start at the beginning of kind of your journey in the cannabis industry. You know, you kind of started out working in the traditional industry, different production companies throughout the 80s. But then in 1998, you bought an old campground called Area 101, you know, which became the birthplace of the Emerald Cup. And I'm kind of curious, what was the drive to originally buy that campground and kind of lead the traditional market?
Well, I'd already left the traditional market. I was in cannabis my whole life. So I came up here and got the property across the street from Area 101 a number of years earlier, and I was doing some pretty large illegal indoor farms on there. And the people across the street, this old campground and little store, and it had a lot of stuff going on, gas station and whatnot. It had been run down. There had only been three owners over 120 years, and the guy died, gave it to his daughter, and she had a bunch of crankers living there. And they called it the home of the night people. That's what the county did. If they had probation violations, they'd go there first. And then the year before I bought it, they had explosions. They had a couple of attempted rapes, robberies, crank labs going off. I mean, you name it. And so I just needed to get those people out of there, and I got the chance to buy it. It wasn't called Area 101 at the time, but it fell to me, and I was able to purchase that. And it was because they had to get the gas tanks cleaned up, and back then MTBE was a big additive in the gas, and they needed to get that out of there because it was toxifying. They were trying to clean the gas up, and it was actually making an environmental disaster throughout the state. So it was costing about $100,000 to $300,000 for each gas station to clean up. And I meditated for 50 years, and I got in my prayers that I'd be okay. So I put $45,000 up and had the testing done and told the owner that I'd probably lose the money because it was probably going to be a couple hundred thousand to clean up the site. It wasn't going to be worth it. But I wanted a great deal on it. So it turned out to be the cleanest site in California, somehow miraculously. And I got the place for $175,000 because she needed to get it done, and I got a good deal. So that's how I got Area 101. I had to go in there, and I spent 2 years getting rid of all the crank freaks and cleaning up all the garbage. They'd been trading dump space for crank. And it took me 2 years, $25,000 in dump fees and 10 or 15 dumpsters to get out of there and clean it up so I could actually start over with the new place called Area 101. Home of the Emerald
Cup. What was the impetus that actually made you want to start the Emerald Cup at that site? You know, with all the venues and all the places you could do it. I know that you had a connection, you know, to the Northern California growing community. But what was that trigger that actually made you say, hey, you know, let's get together, let's try to figure out what is the best way to make this industry real?
Well, what happened was, Area 101 is right on the highway, right on 101, 10 miles north of Laytonville, at the base of Spyrock Mountain. So it's at least for the Mendocino County, it's the heart of the, the cannabis farming area, the old outlaw country. And so we were doing a lot of business there. I was growing across the street. I had a lot of people coming in and out. And we were just talking about how we wanted to have a celebration of the fall harvest and a friendly competition, and why don't we just do it? And my place fit. It was right there. I was crazy enough to be willing to say yes and go for it. And the next thing we're putting up bands and getting everything together and putting a competition together. And we just did it, even though most people thought we'd be arrested. And most of the people that showed up were in masks or disguises or whatnot. And the people that won the first and third didn't even show up to get their prizes. And we actually pulled that off. But it was pretty ballsy thing for back then, because people were still going to prison for long periods of time. So looking back on it, God, I was kind of crazy, but I've always been a little bit eccentric, so it didn't matter.
Well, you know, looking back, because it's been years since, you know, the Emerald Cup first started, one of the most prestigious events, you know, in the world, be it in cannabis or not, you know, when you're taking a look at the years since you started the event, you know, first at, you know, Area 101, what is your fondest memory, you know, across all that time?
Well, probably the first year, because it was just so organic and it was unbelievable that we were even trying to pull something off, and it was just larger than life that we actually just went for it. That's a really tough one. But, you know, another one would be when they busted the 9.31 program where you could grow 99 plants legally, and they took that out. The feds came in and they threatened to arrest us all, and people were telling me not to do the cut that year. It was about 9 years ago. And 10 years ago, and I was going to cancel the cup. And then I just figured, no, fuck it, we're going to just go for it. We're just going to do it anyway. And that's when all the lawyers came up from the Bay Area, all the activists came up, and it really bonded together the whole Bay Area and California scene with all the farmers up here. And they stood tall with us. All these lawyers were there waiting for them to come bust us. And we just went for it. My girl at the time and I just went ahead and produced that cup there. And it was really a really uniting moment for the whole community across the state. And then, of course, going to Santa Rosa and that first year of legalization where we realized that 64 had passed, that was a pretty big year too. And there's a lot of big years in there. I'll tell you what, every year at the Emerald Cup is a special year.
Well, it's, you know, it's definitely one, you know, the most special event that I've ever been to. I mean, I, you know, just attending, you know, I hitting that leaf blower and ending up on the LA Times. I mean, that's my personal fondest memory, you know, but the camaraderie at, you know, the Emerald Cup is literally unheard of at any other consumer event. It, you know, it's just like one big family, and, you know, you working with your daughter, I think, helps facilitate that. But when you were building the event and starting to grow it, how did you manage to maintain that type of environment even as you expanded?
Well, it helped that I didn't care about making any money. So, you know, the whole thing was about putting on the best show for the people and for my family and my community. And so we always went and spared no expense in bringing the best food in. It was always an organic competition, but the food was always organic. Back in Area 101, we'd have people come in and make hundreds of cookies and desserts and stuff for all these people. We'd bring in couches so everybody could feel the energy, put up tents. We'd have an overnight party. Psychedelics would be given out at midnight. I'd give a free breakfast to everybody in the morning who was still standing. We called it a survivor's breakfast. So everybody knew it was just like a no-holds-barred, you know, wild party all the way through. When we moved it to Santa Rosa, it was like, how are we going to maintain that feeling? And so the first few years, until the county wouldn't let me do it anymore, I'd go down and I'd go to Salvation Army and I'd buy over 100 couches. And I'd bring in couches and put them all over the place and make it feel like you were at home. And we get all these organic decorations and put stuff all over the place and just go to great lengths to really make it really, really cool, give out entries to everybody. But, you know, it really, as it grew, everybody was infectious. And so all of our volunteers spread that culture, and all the vendors and sponsors carried that. I've had people come over from the East Coast all the time. They come up and say, you know, we thought we wouldn't really welcome, but we come to the Emerald Cup, and everybody makes us feel like we're at home. So I think it's the whole community, you know, it's a gathering of the tribe for the annual fall harvest, and everybody's just in a festive mood, and it's in a great space, and the whole community conveys that to all the attendees coming, and so everybody feels welcome, and they just all feel like they're part of a special, magical moment, and I'm really proud of everybody for, you know, their part in really making that reality.
And, you know, I know I've mentioned it to you before, you know, just at the 2018 Emerald Cup, you know, it rained and you guys had, you know, umbrellas literally just out for people to take to make sure that they didn't get wet. And it was kind of ran on an honor system. I mean, you just wouldn't see that at any other event. And I you know, it's something that is a fond memory of mine that I think, you know, helps solidify exactly why the Emerald Cup is as special as it is. You know, you guys obviously are very big on regenerative farming practices and making sure, you know, that it's a sustainable industry. You know, when you're taking a look at, you know, green initiatives, There are other markets currently coming online that could benefit from that knowledge that maybe haven't attended the Emerald Cup, you know, say in Oklahoma, obviously, where things are proliferating, or other Midwestern or East Coast states. What advice would you have for those emerging markets on how to make sure that they can be sustainable as well?
Well, the testing was a big thing. We brought in SC Labs in. They came in the first show 10 years ago, and people weren't sure why they were there, because why would we need testing for our industry? Then the next couple of years, when we started testing for, you know, THC and then terpenes, and we got into all the chemical analysis for pesticides and stuff, we found that a lot of people weren't doing best practices. There were a lot of things that were failing, and it was a wake-up call for the industry. So I think testing early on, and letting people really know that they've got to do best practices, really counts. I think teaching people and educating them that organic flowers and products are going to be better medicine and better products for the consumers. They're going to taste better. They're going to smell better. They're going to look better. And that's just proven. So I think that's a really big part of it. And they can not make the mistakes that we did, toxifying our creeks and our streams and a lot of things that people did up here, which brings in the fish and game and a lot of the water boards and whatnot. And then you start getting heavy regulation and heavy-handed stuff. So it's really, you know, teaching people and educating them to really taking care of their lands and being stewards of it. There's a documentary out called Kiss the Ground, and they took, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres in China, some of the oldest farmland that they'd ruined, and they started using regenerative farm practices, and they proved that you could restore that land. It was really an eye-opening thing for me to see, because I've always understood regenerative farming practices, but at that level, to see what's possible means that we can go across the Midwest, we can go across this whole country, and regenerate this fallow ground that we've toxified with all these pesticides and chemicals, and save the animals and the frogs and the insects and the people from the devastation that comes with using those kinds of practices. So, you know, it's going to come across in Oklahoma. It's going to go everywhere. Regenerative farming is what the name of the game is. Sustainable farming, we've got to go in there and do that. And I'm really proud that the Emerald Cup has always been organic. And as the bar got raised, we moved it into regenerative farming practices so we can really teach people. And it's critical.
Well, and you know, the cannabis... Yeah, and the cannabis that goes into the Emerald Cup is, you know, clearly for anybody who's ever attended the Cup, is the best cannabis, some of the best cannabis in the world, and it's, you know, most of it is all out, I mean, all of it's all outdoor organic, you know, grown, you know, to the highest standards. When you're looking at those criteria, though, for cannabis, what are the criteria for the selection process, and what makes the cut for the Emerald Cup? Because I mean, it's such a fantastic product. Each of the winners, obviously, winners in more than just California for sure in terms of genetics.
Well, I mean, you know, there's a number of things in there. You know, if you look back at the winners over the time, first of all, you know, I had a guy come in with 28% THC years ago and said he was going to win the Cup, and I said, "You're not going to win the Cup. I bet you $100." And he said, "Why?" Because I said, "The THC's never won the Cup. It's always been a combination of the cannabinoids and the terpenes that make something special." Whether, you know, you go back and, you know, the runts, you go back and over the years, the different flavors, the different things people have gone for. It's not just OGs like it was in the beginning. The beginning was a lot of fuels. Now, you know, you see the Skittles and you got cookies and you got your gelatos, you got all the crosses coming in. And so you really got to find a unique cultivar that really the judges, you know, see that uniqueness. But in addition to that, if you look at the winners over the years, Derek, who's won more times at the Cup than anybody, I think he's got 17 awards, he hand waters his plants while he prays over them. You know, and I tell Jeez. People, yeah. They come in, I said, you show me a farm boy from the Midwest who loves growing tomatoes and pumpkins, and that guy's going to be a good cannabis farmer because he loves growing things, okay? And it's like Derek brings that reverence. You know, you talk about, you know, mom's home cooking, you know, the soup, you know, why is it? Because they put that love into it. And there's something beyond just planting something and growing it. There's the love and the reverence you have for it. And if you look at Mark, you know, the Green Shock, and you look at, you know, Jason Ridgeline, you know, these people all love cannabis. They love farming and growing, you know, me and Gene, all of them, you know, and Jackson, you know, you got people that really love it. So if you want to do it right, you can't go in there thinking for money, and you can't go in there, you know, thinking for glory. You got to do something that makes you proud, that you want to do something really special. And you can see that in all the winners and stuff. They're really doing something that they're really proud of, and they're doing it the right way. So
well,
I tell them it's the reverence, really. It's bringing reverence to it.
Yeah, I was going to say tender love and care, I mean, in anything that you do, I think, is that special sauce, especially when it comes to farming. I mean, it's almost an art as much as it is a science. You know, and a lot of these farmers that are putting out genetics, I mean, people come from all over the country to the Emerald Cup to try to understand, you know, better genetics. I mean, the races for the new drops every single year are just intense to see the lines. But I have to ask, you know, and I got to put you a little bit on the spot. You know, if you had to pick one of the winners across all of the years, what was your favorite winner and why?
Oh boy, you know, there's so many that have come across. That is a tough one going back. You know, going back, the first winner was a Purple Kush, and it was grown by an 86-year-old man. His son gave him the clone. And he gave us the award because he said he was going to be dead before he ever got to utilize it. So we still have that first prize. And that Purple Kush was an early-on version. And back then, everybody wanted perps and the purple in the Bay Area. But then down south, it was all the OGs and the fuels. And this was the first one of the hybrids where they took those fuels and OG and mixed it with the purple. And it was called a Purple Kush. And it was phenomenal because it had the terpenes and it had the high. And that really was the beginning of, okay, it's not really just the perps on the one side with people in the Northern California really wanted, or the fuels down south. It was the combination of the terpenes and the high. And so that Purple Kush was really something, and it was very strong. I saw, as soon as I saw it, I knew it was the winner because it just was heads and bubs, you know, everything else. But I'll tell you what, there's been a lot of great product over the years. Every year it's, you know, wonderful to see the new varieties, and the genetics coming in are phenomenal. You know, you started with Leo and Aficionado, you know, back in the day, and you know, you look and see that for a while, you know, John Vergados, who was publisher of Skunk Magazine before they busted him for being the international seed dealer he was, he came out and wanted to really look into genetics. But, you know, it got to the point where for a long time, if you didn't have a fuel, you couldn't sell it. If it wasn't an OG, if it wasn't a Sour D or something, you'd have a hard time selling it. And so it started restricting all the genetic diversity because people really needed to get those. And over the last 7, 8, 9 years, to see that diversity come back and everybody looking for the next cookies, you know, the next Skittles, you know, the crosses, like all the versions of the cakes and the runts and everything, it's so diverse now, I can't even keep up with it. I'm so busy and I'm writing and stuff, and I look at there's like so many new strains. I have to spend every day of the whole year getting nothing but high just to check all the new varietals and cultivars that are coming out. It's just so phenomenal. And it makes me excited for the future. You know, it's not going to be restricted. It's limitless, and everybody's really getting into it, and it's really a fun thing. And, you know, two things you had back, that leaf blower. That leaf blower is the photo. That got more traction than anything we've ever done with you in that photo. And we got in so much trouble from the county fairgrounds and whatnot because of that. It's like allowing what they're calling a dangerous piece of equipment in there. But it was, people loved that picture. They will never get enough of that picture. And the umbrellas that you're talking about, that was really a special piece. We put in flooring. We spent $200,000 in flooring so every handicapped person could move around easily, and there'd be spongy flooring so the vendors wouldn't get tired during the day standing on hard ground. And I couldn't imagine who spends $220,000 on flooring. And I went out and saw this stuff, and they wove it through all the tents and whatnot. And the handicapped people came up to us and said they'd never had an experience where they could go everywhere and be part of it. And then we hired a special handicapped crew to take care of them all. And we had a couple hundred different handicapped people come through that were able to have an experience that seeing the faces and the joy and stuff, it was worth every penny of it just to see that. So that's what I'm saying. Our crew goes to that kind of length because it's like, okay, what are we going to make that's special, that people really feel like they're loved? And then they put that love out to everybody else. So, yeah, the whole thing's a wonderful experience for me.
I was gonna say that picture, I definitely, because I was still at, I believe that picture was taken day one of the Emerald Cup, and then I was still there on day two when my phone started exploding. I think I was getting about 30 text messages a minute saying, hey, by the way, check the LA Times. But yeah, no, I mean, like I said, you know, experiencing the Emerald Cup is almost a spiritual event for cannabis aficionados, people that are, consider themselves connoisseurs. And I think that, you know, people that haven't experienced what the Cannabis Cup is have really missed out. And like I said, I would encourage anybody who hasn't actually attended a cannabis, an Emerald Cup before, for the cannabis industry or not, whether you're just curious about, you know, cannabis for medicine, or, you know, even for just from a scientific standpoint. I mean, just seeing the different genetics that exist at the Emerald Cup is just phenomenal. Now, you have expanded what the Emerald Cup is, especially in 2018. I know you guys added the Willie Nelson Award. I'm kind of curious, you know, because Willie Nelson is obviously one of the most prolific advocates for the cannabis industry. He's been doing it for a very long time. How did that come about? And what was the determination that, you know, Willie Nelson was the guy?
Well, we'd gone through and done a lot of the lifelong activists and people who've been in the industry, you know, Debbie Goldsberry and Valerie Correll and just all these wonderful people, and Pebbles Trippett, you know, Jack and Ed Rosenthal. And then we were looking out and saying, you know, who's another oldster that's really done it for this community? And of course, the first name everybody came up with was Willie. You know, he wasn't like a lifetime dealer, but as far as an activist, a guy that had got himself arrested several times because he just refused to stand down, who always spoke out, who epitomized, you know, what we are all about and who we are, it was clear it was Willie. Willie had to be the guy. But it was like, for us, it was like, would he do this? Would he do it for us? And we reached out through circles and got a hold of him, and he looked at it. Took some time. Of course, you don't get a yes or no from a guy like Willie, obviously, instantly. And he finally came back to us, and it was the greatest joy in my life, one of the high moments of the Cup overall ever, when he said, yeah, I want to do it, but I want to change it from the Lifetime Achievement Award to the Willie Nelson Award forever. If you guys are okay with that, then I'll come do it. And we're like, are we okay with that? I mean, it's like, how do you say no to that? I mean, how do you do that? So it became the Willie Nelson Award, and of course he showed up and took that award, and it was. I mean, I was on the stage. I still got pictures of it. I was barely able to speak. I had to be on the stage with Willie at that point in his life, and to be able to honor him with that, and for him to come in. You know, those Lifetime Achievement Awards. We did Dennis Perrone before he passed away, and he did his wedding on stage with us, and we've had some really magical moments on that stage with the winners of those awards. And of course, then following that, how do you follow that? And so last year, we thought the only person we could bring in was Tommy Chong. You know, you got to bring in Tommy. And Tommy came, and it was like he was a perfect person to follow Willie. And this year, we're doing Winona Duke, a Native American who's been, you know, out there evangelizing for hemp and civil rights and minorities her whole life, and just a wonderful lady. And Willie's agreed to come online and present the award to her. So that's a really magical thing that's going to happen this year, too.
That's incredible. I mean, you know, there's very few people that have spent a lifetime in advocacy, you know, such as, you know, people like Willie Nelson or Tommy Chong, just literal legends in the industry. But, you know, I think you're selling yourself a little bit short. You know, you've been an advocate for several years yourself. When you're taking a look at how the cannabis industry has kind of shifted here in California, what do you think in terms of legislation that has been done correctly? And, you know, being a lifetime advocate yourself, you know, what would you like to see be done here in California? Because obviously the patchwork system is kind of finicky. You know, I'd be curious, if you had a blank canvas, what would it look like?
Well, you know, I came out with Pebbles, and we did the first sheriff's debate in the country, where we had law enforcement get together with cannabis farmers to talk about how we'd live together. That was 14 years ago, and we got Tom Allman elected. It went so well that we had the runoff. We had four sheriff candidates, and we had the two sheriff candidates come back, and then the district attorney liked it so much they came out. So in the course of 6 months, we had the first time in the country in the world where law enforcement and district attorneys got together with cannabis people to figure out how we could live together. And then from there, we created the 9.31 program, which was the first program in the country where you could grow 99 plants legally with the sheriff's permit. And the feds came in and busted that program because they weren't going to have it because it was so successful. We delivered almost $1 million to the sheriff's department. So I've always been on the road towards advocacy for legalization. Even though when I did those sheriff's debates, I got death threats from the people behind me on Spyrock because they said I was going to ruin the industry. And I was like, you know what? It can't be about making money or personal greed. When people are still going to prison for 15 years and patients can't get access, it has to be altruistic. We've got to go for legalization. So I've been in there since the beginning of that, kind of one of the first maybe outlaw advocates, not just an activist, but coming from the outlaw world. And I'm really proud of that. And you know, I helped do all the other initiatives. 64, I advocated for. Gavin Newsom came up here and promised, Governor Gavin Newsom came up here and promised, no matter what, that he'd stick to the no farming larger than 1 acre for 5 years so that all these legacy farmers could slowly sunset, you know, away without having to compete against that. And then 2 months into 64, he allowed large-scale farming to come in, and it destroyed, you know, most of the legacy farmers and the small farmers throughout the Emerald Triangle and throughout this state. Because now you've got 20-acre farms in Santa Barbara, Salinas, Sacramento. Now they're Lake County's filling up with these farms. And Mendocino is just now passing their own bill because they stick with 10,000 square feet farms, quarter acre, but they can't compete. And so they're now going to open it up in Mendocino, which is going to be kind of the final death knell of you know, the small farmers in a certain way. So for me, I would have gone back and stuck with Gavin and what 64 was meant to be, which was, I'm sorry for all the large farms and I'm sorry for all the big brands. You're going to have to stick to 1 acre or less for 5 years so that these legacy small farmers who created this industry and fought for it, went to prison, their families and their kids, they have a chance to make it. And so I would start with that. I would have never allowed large-scale farming like they did. And I would have given a lot of benefit to these legacy farmers and these people to do that. Now, I understand that on the other side, for consumers, it's going to mean that the prices go down, there's a lot more access, there's even more brands, there's a lot of benefits to that. I understand, but you know, this industry was built on the backs of a lot of outlaws and small craft farmers in these mountains. They gave up decades in their lives to do this, and they didn't get a fair shake. And it's not right, and I got a lot of blame for that. People have come after me hard saying I voted for 64 and advocated for it, but I didn't advocate for what Gavin Newsom said and did, and that's why I signed for his recall, even though I voted for Gavin, because he lied to all of us, and it's not okay.
Well, you know, when you're taking a look at the industry and kind of how it's evolved since 64, especially as far as craft cannabis is concerned, and you're looking at the Northern California communities, the latest fights seem to be between, at least as far as I'm seeing, has been between, you know, the wine farmers or the wine communities, say in Santa Barbara, or, you know, for instance, you know, those other types of, you know, well, mainly the wineries. I mean, you're taking a look at, you know, people saying, okay, well, it's, you know, you're pollinating my crops, and then you go back on the other side, you know, there's pesticide runoff. Do you see maybe a placation between those two industries? I mean, obviously we have wine tourism. Do you eventually see an industry where there is, you know, craft farming tourism or just general farming tourism in Northern California?
Oh, no, tourism is going to be a big business. It's already coming in. They're going to, as soon as we get done with COVID, that's going to be a huge thing. The reason why the vineyards and the traditional farming communities don't like cannabis is because we're held to standards that are 100 times more stringent than they are. They don't have to worry about their runoff or what they do. They can spray all kinds of toxic chemicals on their plants, and we have to be clean. And so, you know, you're down there in Salinas or Santa Barbara, and these farms next to you are just spewing toxic shit all over the broccoli and all over the food crops and everything, the vineyards and whatnot, and we can't get away with that, so we're suing them. and we're seeing issues come in there. And of course, the vineyard and all the other traditional industries are like, look, we don't want to be judged like cannabis people because then we'll all fail. Well, excuse me, the bottom line is, whoever gave those industries a pass to put all that toxic stuff on our food and our grapes and whatnot, how did we ever allow them to do that? Because cannabis people shouldn't be given a break, but the other industries should have to live up to that bar too. So that's why they haven't wanted to be near cannabis people. Now in Mendocino and a lot of places, you're seeing a lot of these vineyards that voted against us and fought with us. They want to tear out part of their vineyards to put cannabis in there because they're making 10 times as much off an acre of cannabis as they are off a set of grapes. So it's changed really, really quickly. And it's an amazing thing that's taking place. There is going to be a merging of the industries. It's going to come together, and it's going to come to a head because they're going to have to figure out, are we going to make cannabis people open to living the way the rest of farming is, or are we going to make traditional farming rise up and start cleaning up their act too? Cannabis, it's really making everybody look at what we've allowed in farming for the last 100 years. It goes back to the whole regenerative farming thing. We've allowed such toxic farming across this country, and it's poisoned all these workers and all these humans and all the life on the planet, and it's just time to stop. We've got to clean it up.
Do you ever see maybe the traditional market industries, such as the vineyards, taking on some of the cannabis regenerative practices that are being done up in Northern California?
Oh, they all are going to. If you see that documentary, Kiss the Ground, they're doing it now in the traditional farms in the Midwest, and they're seeing that, we're going to need to do this because we've destroyed the ground. You can only grow with toxic chemicals for so long. You're killing all the biology, all the living, entities in there, and the mycelium network and everything, and it doesn't live. It's not sustainable. You have to put more and more on there, and it doesn't work. You can't go the way of Roundup and Monsanto because they're destroying the world with that. So we're going to have to go back to regenerative farming practices, and we're leading the way in cannabis, and I'm very proud of that. And people like John Rulak, who put together Kiss the Ground, and these other farmers that are showing now with regenerative farming practices what's possible, they're going to definitely have to go back to that because we can't go on the way we are, or we're going to poison the rest of the earth, and we're not going to live here anymore.
That's right. And I mean, and you guys are definitely the leaders of that. The seminars at the Emerald Cup are some of the most comprehensive that exist in the industry as it regards to, regenerative or sustaining practices in the cannabis industry. You touched on COVID-19 a little bit. Obviously, COVID-19 has kind of ravaged the entire world, especially the events industry. You guys are switching to a digital event this year. It's currently going on now. I believe it started, December 20th. What is the process that was involved for you guys in trying to figure out how to do this type of cannabis sampling for the judges in a digital atmosphere?
Well, for a lot of the contests, we have over 40 contests now. For a lot of the contests, it's not that big of an issue because if you're talking about an edible or a tincture, it's not as much of a need to get together in person for visuals and to go through each one of the entries as it is for the flowers or the concentrates. The flowers, it's really nice to get the team together and have everybody go through it all and be able to really compare notes and talk about it. So we're still having the flowers judging in-person meetings. The rest of the contests we're going to do by Zoom, and it's not going to be as impactive because, like I said, it's not as critical for the, for the in-person, camaraderie to go through and look at each one of the entries. So I feel pretty good about that. Our judges, we keep about half the judges returning, so they really know what they're doing. So we have a good set of lead judges, and my daughter and Taylor and Dickie really know how to run that with us. So. We're in a well-oiled machine on that note, and so I don't think we're going to have any issue with that. The digital broadcast show, we're working with Social Club TV and the folks, former folks at, I'm just thinking that, forget their name right now, Prohibited, I'm sorry. Too many meetings today. The former folks at Prohibited, Josh and Jason. And, they're doing Social Club TV, and they really know what they're doing. So we get the chance and the opportunity. Every crisis is an opportunity in life, And we're getting the opportunity to go across the country and across the world to be able to convey the message and inspire and educate people in a way that we never would have it before. So we're looking at this as a real opportunity, and we'll carry on from this year on every year with the streamed broadcast, because it's we're realizing what an effective way it is for people to see all the entries and all the winners and the whole inside of the cup and the culture and the panels and whatnot. So really, it's been a really good thing for us on that note, and we're very excited about carrying it forward. And we're going to raise the bar for a digital broadcast show so people can really see how to do it right, too. So now when we go to LA next year, we'll have the live version in person, and we'll also have the digital.
And I was going to say the hybrided version of any type of event seems to be the future of events, and especially now being in cannabis, is you have the international markets coming online, you have different markets across the country here nationally coming online. I think it's a fantastic thing, and I can't wait to watch the live stream. When you were trying to figure out how you wanted to kind of roll out this move into Southern California or everywhere else, what was your impetus to be able to say, okay, Northern California, I love my flagship, as you go elsewhere, especially as you're doing it digitally, what was that drive?
Well, when we moved out of Mendocino and the Emerald Triangle, we couldn't get a venue up here because we'd gotten too big. And fairgrounds, it's interesting, the fairgrounds in Humboldt and Mendocino wouldn't let us in, but Sonoma County would. And people were like, oh, you're abandoning the Emerald Triangle. And half the people wouldn't come into the event. A lot of the old schoolers thought we were being sacrilegious or something. But then when they heard how much business everybody did with direct interaction to the consumers, everybody wanted to join up, and we had a waiting list the second year. And then, of course, winning the awards in front of a 15,000-person audience was a nice benefit, too. So people realized, this is the way to go. Well, we got to the same point with thinking about L.A. Where's the best place for somebody to win an award? On a stage in L.A., it's like the Academy Awards. And where's the best place for a vendor to go and sell their wares? L.A., where, three-quarters of the market is. So everybody was like, no, that's we get it. We're ready to go. So there wasn't anybody holding back on that. We're still going to do a celebration of the fall harvest and a gathering in Sonoma each year so that people can bring the latest genetics in. We can do the latest flowers, and people can still have that communal tribal gathering. But the big show will be in March of 2022 in L.A., and we also backed up the contest because there wasn't a time for judging. With people getting the flowers in, getting them to the distributors, and then tested back in, packaged back to us. It wasn't enough time. So they finally convinced me that it was the right way to go. So we backed the contest up to do the judging through February and into March, and then do the show in late March in L.A. And people are excited as heck. I mean, we were so excited about going down to L.A. this year. And, of course, we couldn't because of COVID, but where's the best place to really represent all of California and put on a global show? There's no place better than L.A., and we're very honored and excited to go down there and put that show on in 2022.
Well, and you have been consuming cannabis for so long. Being somebody that has, seen so many different strains and so many different genetics and so many different types of evolution within the industry, obviously, 20 or 30 years ago, hash was the big thing. Now you're seeing kind of high-end concentrates. What is your favorite way to consume cannabis, and what is your current favorite strain and why?
Well, I now consume through vaporization. I shot my lungs a number of years ago, I really had 40 years, 50 years of smoking joints. I was an old joint guy, 10 joints a day, and I just had to give that up. So I started learning how to vaporize. I love the concentrates. I watch concentrates go from hash to where they started making really high-end hash where it was not even pressed. It was like not even put into a press, and they were making it really just molded. And then I saw the beginnings of BHO when they were first blasting it through tubes. We were double boiling it and then hitting that with hot knives and stuff. I was part of the old school stuff. And then into the live rosin and then seeing the live resin. So I've watched that whole evolution of all that come in. And it's really been a remarkable thing for me to really see. I mean, I love our Durban Sherbert concentrates that we make. That's a really amazing, you know, cultivar that we have, and that came in for the concentrates. And then, of course, genetics, you know, breeding for concentrates. You know, you had to really be able to find something that not only gave you the terpenes but actually spit enough, because it became a lot of that stuff was great, but it didn't give you the amount that you needed, not with live rosin anyway. So that became a whole art form in itself, you know, coming in there. And, you know, I love, you know, the runs that came out from Ridgeline. I thought the runs was a great strain, you know, bringing in against that gassy, but also the fruit and stuff. I love that coming in. And I love my friend Tony's Skittles, you know, the original Skittles that Tony Mendocino came up with. I mean, I love that Skittle strain that they came through and they brought in. And so I love both of those. You know, they're amazing. I still love the Sugaree, which is an old strain that 1 year ago my friend didn't like the fuels, and he bred a Sugaree, which was a KC36 times skunk. It was very unique. It was more of a sativa and light high, but it got you really strong. So it had, you know, had the power to really push it. And the Sugaree won a number of times at the cup, placed I think about 6 or 7 times. So I really like that strain too. You know, but this year we'll see what comes in. There, you know, you see all the different versions of the cakes and the you know, versions of the runts coming in, and there's just so much coming in. Skittles versions, you know, 20 varieties of Skittles versions, crosses. So it'll be interesting to see what this year, you know, holds for us and where it comes from. You know, Mark Greenshock last year had an orange guava that was just a stunning strain also that I really liked. So, you know, I really do, but for me, because I'm vaping and stuff, I really like to do concentrates. I like to do live rosin. And I like to do the finest live rosin in the world through vaporization.
Awesome. Well, hopefully I get to judge at some point in the Emerald Cup. It's been an honor to talk with you, Tim. Again, you are you know, an inspiration for a lot of people in the industry. Somebody who, you know, does both the industry side as well as the advocacy side, and somebody that really believes in what the future of this industry is. Really, really thank you for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I really enjoy our conversations, Nick. You're one of the guys coming up that's really going to take that baton and lead and guide and inspire this industry for decades to come. So I know that it's in good hands with people like you and my daughter and everybody else. So I look forward to it, and we will get you into judging. I'll tell you what, next year we'll get you in there for sure. We'll awesome. I'll make sure that you get in there, and we'll see it. And I look forward to seeing you sometime in the near future. We'll try some of the entries.
Yes, sir, and it definitely look forward to seeing you in person. Hopefully sooner rather than later. You're an absolute legend in the industry. Been talking with Tim Blake again, founder of the world-renowned Northern California cannabis consumer event, the Emerald Cup. Really appreciate your time, brother.
We would like to thank Tim for his time and being on today's episode. You can find out more about the Emerald Cup by visiting them online at www.theemeraldcup.com. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of Conversations in Cannabis.